Gym 7 podcasts. Now I've wanted to do a podcast for a little while, and with shows like the Coffee Geek podcast and the Portafilter podcast coming back, I wanted to do something that was maybe a little bit different, and I also wanted to create a format for these things that I feel I can stick to, so I can regularly produce some shows and have them be interesting and have them be, I hope, worth listening to. So the idea is that each time I'm going to call up somebody, initially probably some friends in the coffee industry, and we're going to talk for a little while about topics that I find interesting and I hope they find interesting, and ideally you listening find interesting too. And my first phone call is going to be with Stephen Morrissey. I'm going to start. I want to ask about TED Coffee. Because last year at the TED conference, and I'm going to just presume that anyone listening to this knows what TED is. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Because
we hope.
You hope. Last year, Intelligentsia did coffee service for TED, right?
Yep.
What did that involve?
It's 1,800 people. It's sold out. I think for the next year, it's sold out as well, I believe. And these people often spend like $6,500 to be there, and they're this very kind of interesting group of you know, progressive, forward-thinking, and intelligent. We joked that it was the intelligentsia of the world in some ways, that it was kind of just this very sort of enlightened group, all looking to kind of have their preconceptions shattered and have ideas and be learned something. And we went there and set up five coffee bars in total.
Okay.
And it required around 30 staff, which was difficult to assemble, but
sure.
The idea was, and we hired the we didn't even hire, she was happy to help us, the architect from our last two bars in Los Angeles, Anna Henton, who's a disciple of Frank Gehry. She actually was excited to be involved as well, and she designed the bars for us. So we had these really gorgeous bars, because I think at an event like this, you really don't want it to seem like you're just doing luxury coffee for rich people. Which, you know, it's a, which I think is a Peter Giuliano's line, actually. But it's a need to, you really want to make sure. And I think any event, whenever we do any kind of a, be it a food show, be it a fashion event, anything, there's always an attempt to make the bars feel much more kind of concrete and permanent than having to a fold-out table with a blank.
Yeah, the trade show booth kind of.
Right, yeah. I think it's, they immediately put you into a box and just say, what do you have, and, you know, and give me a 4-ounce sample and I'll keep walking. But if you can change it, and if you can do ceramic, and if you can just change what the bar looks like and feels like, then you can change that. Like, people walk up with a very different open mind to it. But so we spent a lot of time working with how those bars looked and felt, and they're long days. I think they were like 14-hour days working, but What was fascinating was that you have this TED audience, and on the first day, there was still, despite all our efforts, an element of you were treated a little bit like catering.
Yeah.
People were not kind of, they were more excited to be at TED than they were to be getting good coffee, and they might have been recognizing that it was that, you know, the coffee service was pretty comprehensive, but it was, you know, their main excitement was at TED. And then day two, they sort of recognized the same people working behind the bars. And then day three, the conversations really started. And by day five, there was people trading numbers, and there was kind of really strong friendships that had kind of been established between the TED attendees, you know, speakers included, and the baristas. And that was really cool. And it was always, we only did espresso that year.
Yeah.
And we had bulk brewed coffee as well. There was a big worry from TED that we wouldn't be able to handle the volume, but it's just funny because we all work in busy shops, you know, so it's kind of like, I think we're fine. And there was also, there's this big misconceptions of how much coffee they'd go through. They were saying 250 pounds of espresso a day, which is a lot.
It's a lot of coffee.
it ended up being that for the week. But
that's still a lot of coffee.
Oh yeah, it's busy. I mean, they're long days, and you know, it was fascinating, and some of the conversations you got to have. And I remember like talking to a woman from National Geographic, and we were just joking about, she was like one of the head editors, and then we were making some joke about Latte Art or something, and one guy was joining in, and it was like the founder of Facebook. I don't think it was Zuckerberg, but it was someone who was one of the main guys at Facebook, and you're like, oh, I've heard of Facebook. And it was weird because and David Byrne coming up to you, and then, you know, Arianna Huffington and Al Gore and Bill Gates, and you're serving people like that. And the hope is that just one or two of them will walk away thinking about coffee differently. And that's what you and I were talking about before, that we weren't there thinking every person would walk away a, you know, for life intelligentsia customer. The hope was that they would walk away thinking about coffee differently.
Yeah.
And start looking for that same kind of experience elsewhere.
We do need to talk about this year's TED, because this year's TED is totally different.
Totally different.
Sorry, and Kyle. And it's a really interesting thing, and I can hear your phone in the background, and that's okay. So TED this year.
This year, it's a little different. We decided to open it up this year. And in the same vein that that the goal for us was not to, obviously the exposure for intelligentsia was wonderful, but the kind of nature of TED is you don't plaster up branding. It's not a massive kind of, they really encourage our sponsors to be not too commercial about it. And yeah, we kind of subscribe to that. And it was one of the nice things I remember them saying is that we were the most TED-like sponsor that they'd ever had, because the way we just built these pretty bars.
Yeah.
And the extent of the branding was literally the cups and our bags on the wall behind us. But this year we decided, well, you know, wouldn't it be great if there was multiple companies involved and multiple and a cross section of baristas from around the world? And what if there was this feeling that it wasn't just one company telling them this is the way it is, this is where coffee is going, because it might just feel a little biased. What if it was from a cross section selection of some of the best coffee companies in the world, best roasters, best farms, and baristas, and they're all saying the same thing, that maybe that will have a much greater resonance with that kind of audience who might be reasonably a little bit skeptical about what one company says.
Yeah.
But it'd be harder to deny what quite a few companies are saying. And so we went about forming myself and Kyle Glanville, reached out to some friends, Peter Giuliano, Nicholas Cho, Brent Fortune, and Tim Williams, and Sean Bonner. And we set about planning to organize this in under a collaborative banner of TED Coffee.
Okay. I didn't know Sean was involved.
Yeah.
Cool.
Sean's our web guy.
All right. So who's involved coffee-wise kind of globally? Who's coming to play?
Right now, as of this recording, the list is Square Mile Coffee, Counterculture Coffee, Intelligentsia Coffee, Stumptown Coffee.
I think you can skip the coffee in these.
Well, and I had to write the list down earlier on, and I kept saying coffee after. This is so redundant. But Counterculture, Square Mile, Intelli, Stumptown, Madcap, mm-hmm. Has Been,
yep.
Ritual, and Tewar.
Okay.
I think that's it for the moment, because I really hope so.
Anyone, because I'm going to ask you about the baristas coming, because you've got a lot of different baristas from all over the place coming over.
Yeah, we really do. I mean, the majority is definitely North America. Well, here's what's really exciting about this is these baristas are funding their own way. We kind of handpicked the baristas we wanted, and they're picked. We're not kind of saying that these are the best baristas in the world, but we're saying these are some of the best baristas in the world.
Yeah.
And they were picked for their coffee brewing skills, but also their communication skills. Mm-hmm. We wanted people who could really kind of control a conversation and kind of inspire through language and kind of just really engage the customers. And, you know, it's that kind of skill of a good barista, I think, knowing how to read the person, you know, and knowing, is this a customer who wants to learn right now, or is this a customer who just wants a coffee? And that I can articulate differently depending.
Absolutely.
I can say, this is a really fruity coffee because coffee's a fruit. Here you go. You know?
Yeah.
Or I can say something much longer, you know? Do you think coffee's a fruit? I always go back and forth on saying coffee's a fruit. because it's not really...
It's not really a fruit. I mean, it's... Yeah.
But it's a nice, lovely little thing to say, but I just don't know if it's entirely accurate.
Yeah, it's a bit like, I don't know, you couldn't really say, like, this cherry stone is a fruit.
Yeah, and that's it. So do you... But so much of what we're talking about is we want the characteristics of a fruit to come through. Like, really good,
sometimes,
ripe...
You know. Sometimes.
Yeah, not always, but... Well, I think, you know, acidity, you know, it's one of the hallmarks of specialty coffee. It's, you know, because I remember having this conversation at WBC with someone who was saying, like, you know, just say someone doesn't want to do an acidic coffee, and they present a coffee in competition that has no acidity whatsoever, and they're kind of standing by that. And the question came up, well, what, you know, can we punish that? Because can we argue that, you know, acidity is something we are absolutely looking for in specialty coffee? That, it, you know, a certain... The quality of the acidity is one thing, but the amount of acidity that, you know, that acid's being something we like to hang on to. That, you know, when acids go away, it's not normally a good thing.
Well, on every single score sheet I've ever used, the number of points awarded to sweetness are exactly the same as the number of points awarded to acidity.
Yeah.
Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. It's that. I mean, acidity is really interesting, and I actually want to talk about TED right now, and I could happily talk about this. No. Like, I feel like there's an acidity argument constantly waiting to happen. But
I think the bitterness argument as well.
The bitterness.
I always think that the and or bitterness from the rule in WBC.
Well, let's just finish up talking about TED real quick.
Well, it's just like the old days.
And then, because I want to talk about the WBC stuff as well.
Okay. So, Ted, that's what we're looking at. We have this, the fact that we invited baristas, and we asked them to pay their own way. We said, can you get here and work? And we kind of had this initial sort of idea that we've kind of moved away from a little bit, but, you know, some of the best baristas in the world working with some of the best coffees from some of the best roasters and serving the best audience in the world. You know, just this kind of notion of these people are coming to this event open-minded, and that's, we need people like that to then kind of expose to a coffee service that is really progressive and kind of next level. And so this year we're doing brewed coffee throughout. So it's actually going to be a special bar that's just alternative methods of brewing.
Okay.
I hate that word alternative sometimes because it suggests that there's one perfect one. Yeah, but we're going to have it. It'll be doing Siphon, Chemex, Aeropress, Woodneck, everything, you know. A little penny university in the middle of all of it.
Don't read it again then.
I mean, and we've designed the bars to be very visible. As in the espresso machines will be perpendicular to the bars. We've got really nice Lamarzocco paddle groups throughout the place. And all the Hario gear we're using is going to be up front. And so they inevitably kind of prompt conversation. And we're just, it's how do you kind of really savor that and get the most out of it. And I think a lot of our baristas we're bringing are probably quite, you know, I'm hoping, and I think we chose them because they are good at communicating, and they are good at kind of even taking the most belligerent customer who really is kind of wanting to make a point at how much they're scoffing at it, and then slowly changing their mind. I've seen it happen, and I think, you know, I don't think TED is so unique that it will kind of present different challenges in that regard.
Okay.
I think the average coffee shop I can just speak to our own, that there is the kind of conversations that happen over the bar.
And just quickly, who, you've got like people coming in from Norway and Australia.
Yeah, we have an Australian recently crowned barista champion. We've got the Canadian barista champion. Mike Phillips will be there for a little bit. He was a barista from Chicago.
Big bodybuilder, right?
I hate those kind of jokes. They're really crap. They're kind of like, you know, industry joke. Very fond of Mike, though, but just I hate those kind of jokes. But I'm a culprit.
You made it.
I realized that.
I merely followed along like a lackey.
Thank God we can edit that out.
Yeah, no.
But we have, we got guys from Norway and I think Denmark as well. The hope is that I would have loved to have had a much more diverse. I'm actually just particularly excited about it at the moment. There's been a couple of developments recently that, in terms of, we're going to really work hard to make sure that we make as much noise as possible about this. That this is sort of I mean, there was Slow Coffee, which was kind of a similar kind of really nice kind of gathering. And I think with the same idea, and we definitely were talking, it was a talking point an awful lot in our early conversations in planning all this was, you know, that we wanted to kind of, bring back that same spirit and that kind of, that we need to educate people and we need people to think about coffee differently. And I mean, especially now with the market the way it is and everything, that we just need people to, you know, to not balk at a $6 cup of coffee, but to balk at a $1 cup of coffee.
Yeah.
That we need to change that. And so I like the idea of kind of coming together under this one brand that exists to educate, and that all of us will do well under that brand, and we'll all support it in a different way, and that knowing that the dividends for us will be a more educated, discerning market base.
Yeah, it's fair. And just quickly before I move you on to the next thing I want to talk about, there's a website.
Yeah, we've developed a website. At the moment, it's called Coffee Worth, which was a sort of a pun on the TED kind of main tagline of ideas worth spreading. Mm-hmm. So we were joking about coffee worth spreading, but that just sounded weird. So, but Coffee Worth sounds kind of fun because that's the worth of coffee. And Coffee Worth, talking about coffee worth, you know, drinking coffee worth, you know, growing. And we, that'll be the home to really tell all the stories we can about this. We're looking to kind of create lots of video and lots of interviews and really archive just how the occasion of all this and have it become a home for that story and kind of, and I guess just to tell the story of the coffee service at TED. The website might change. We have something in the works right now that might kind of, it might change. And if it does, I'm sure James will let you know. But it's going to become, and there'll be a Twitter account and everything. But we're looking to make a lot of kind of, it's going to be really interesting. I think I would stay tuned and keep an eye on it. I'm not pitching it very well here, but it's.
That's all right. No,
we're still conceiving it, but yeah.
All right. Good. So, something we briefly talked about a little bit earlier on was WBC stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Just because last time I saw you, you're coming through London, having been in Italy at yep. Simonelli for judges
certification.
Yeah, and I suppose this gets me into slightly tricky water because I'm a bit of a complainer. Do you know what I mean?
We'll call you a whiner.
A whiner. Thanks.
No. You're a commenter.
You know, rarely welcome. I suppose it's interesting that you've gotten so involved having gone from competing and, you know, going from one side of the table to the other quite dramatically, I guess, because you're now involved and you'll have to refresh my memory on exactly what your role is with kind of...
Well, I'm on the certification committee.
Okay.
I helped out with the events and logistics and, you know, worked with Cindy and Ruki and a couple of others in the brew bar we did for Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
That. Since then, since judging an awful lot, I've wanted to get more involved with that. And I just to kind of that constant challenge of trying to keep up with the competitors as judges.
Well, I think this is something that kind of a lot of competitors feel and kind of moan about to a degree, is that the weak link in barista competition remains judges.
Yeah.
It remains their preconceptions or their attention or whatever it is that, you know, that, and there's a million and one, you know, the problem with barista competitions, I always feel, is that they for a long time, they will run for the winner. And if you have 100 entrants, one person wins and you have 99 people that turned up, and what do they get?
Yeah.
You know, that's, for me, hugely down to the judges.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. And I've sort of kind of used that same sort of rhetoric in doing judges training in the past. And I like to think that the competition exists to not to glorify the winner so much as to kind of educate everyone else. That it should serve the person who came last just as much as it served the top six.
Yeah.
Now, I think that might be a little idealistic and naive, but absolutely the amount that the person you know, the people who didn't make finals will say walk away with should be, they should be walking away with just a massive amount of resources on how they can get better. And they should be just given tons of really, really great feedback they can use to kind of improve their skill set and bring that back to their coffee shops and raise the standard of coffee brewing around the world. And rather than putting one person up on a pedestal and kind of saying this is, I mean, and there's a massive value to that as well. And, you know, obviously, you know, we can speak to this with some, you know, but the ambassadorial role you take on, and there's a huge value to kind of having a champion. But I think it's maybe, to your point, there's been a disproportionate amount of attention on that end of it rather than the value that the people who walk away maybe further down the ranks.
Yeah. I guess the tricky thing is,
which is change, and I'll say that's changing as well. Sorry, I think that's, but there's a very concentrated amount of work happening right now to change that.
Okay. Now I want to ask two different questions, but I'm going to ask the first question anyway. You talked about education and that kind of stuff in terms of someone competing and coming away better. But as I understand it, equally the judges' score sheets are, or the judges' role is quite not restricted, but there's equally a lot of stuff that they shouldn't be saying.
They're not there to comment on or to advise. They're there to record. They're there to say this happened. To say that you said this, but it tasted like this, and you moved this way, and you said you did this, and you know it's really to record it and then use the rules that are given to allow you to give certain kind of scores. Mm-hmm. There has been a problem in the past with judges saying, you know, I would advise using a different type of Brazil for your base, or I would advise you not using high-grown Guatemalas, you know, and these kind of, and that's caused a lot of trouble in the past. And I would love to say that has now been eradicated, but it hasn't. That still pops up. And the big goal at the moment is to make sure that all comments are anchored in the rules. And that requires a very thorough knowledge of the rules, but we kind of are very conscious that the baristas have a very thorough knowledge of the rules, and they'll know how to tweak to their favor. And there's a Mike Strumpf, a really good judge in the US, he has this line I really like, that the perfect score sheet, in terms of a judge's role, the perfect score sheet is one that you don't have to be there to explain it.
Yeah.
But as an editor, you receive a score sheet back, and every single score has a corresponding comment warranting that score and explaining why it wasn't a six.
Yeah.
You know? And I can't say that I filled in that score sheet yet, but that's absolutely my goal. And I write an awful lot, and I try to be as kind of clear as possible. And it's very difficult. And I like Nick Cho has that comment that, you know, it's impossible to judge fairly, and there's a lot of kind of inherent things in the competition. I don't know if that's true, because I think, I got to be careful here, but I do think it tends to pick the right people. Or I'd say the top six are normally fairly, you know, deserved top six places. Yeah. I mean, there's been, you know, controversy over that before, but for the most part, it does a good job of whittling it down to that bunch.
Yeah.
You know? But I think that's been a huge thing is knowing that the competitors are just getting more and more, are pushing the boat so much all the time and getting more progressive, more clever, and innovating all the time. But the judges have to keep up, and the judges, a lot of the training that we do for these WBC certifications is we spend some time talking about trends and what happened last year and how do judges deal with that. You know, Colin Harmon's performance comes up.
Okay.
With the water.
The water thing?
Like, yeah. And that, like, you know, and judging questions like creativity, like, you know, was it just Americano? Or was it something really fascinating and clever, you know? And does creativity mean it has to be quality? And if you've heard of it before, I mean, is it just how do you interpret those scores? And some of the scores do require a lot of discussion to really understand how you judge them. But I feel I can say with a degree of confidence that the sort of the work going on right now at WBC and in the wider WCE group, and as a point, the certification committee that I work on is actually responsible for all the competitions
and
certifying judges to be able to do all of them. We actually did some really great work that actually kind of identified that an awful lot of the qualities we look for in a judge has the parallels. It's not like the kind of qualities you look for in a judge for a last year competition are vastly different to the qualities you look for in WBC. That in an ideal world, they actually are very similar. And so, yeah. I really do kind of feel that the work being done right now is excellent. And there's a really concerted effort and a lot of people kind of working very, very hard to make sure that the competitors are, you know, that their efforts are matched by the judges.
Sure.
And they're just taken seriously. And it isn't there to serve, to glorify the judges.
Do we need more baristas judging? Or ex-competitors judging? Or
That's a nice distinction. I absolutely, judging with ex-competitors, I really enjoy, because as a judge, and this will sound funny, but what I enjoy more often is the 15 minutes after a performance than the actual performance. Mm-hmm. Because then you kind of, it's the conversations you have back there are really fascinating sometimes. And especially when you get competitors who teach you something and kind of make you aware of something or do something different. Because then you can really let it sink in and say, wow, you know, did this speak to their abilities as an ambassador for coffee? Do I feel kind of this person is someone who can go out there and kind of communicate and educate? And, you know, did I feel that their kind of ownership of that bar and in how they, the kind of the quality of their coffee knowledge, mm-hmm. and the accuracy of their coffee knowledge and the way they presented it and the way that kind of information related to the drinks they were serving, and the whole thing feel kind of comprehensive and connected. And was there a degree of insight shown, or was it just somebody reading off the front of a bag?
Can you give me a good example of, or an example of the last time you were kind of blown away by a competitor or really intrigued by something they said or did?
I'm just trying to think of one. I'm trying to think back to Atlanta. I mean, there was... For me, it's silly things, though. I love, like, when Fabrizio from Mexico just had a map and he just, like, leaned over the judges' table and was just, like, pointing down and goes, this is where the coffee is from. It's right here. And he was just over there and he's, like, pointing at it, and it's really kind of, like, just... I just felt incredibly, like, at home and comfortable, and I trusted him. And it felt so genuine. It wasn't kind of this lofty language that was kind of... You know, and you and I, when we've trained for competition, is... not saying what you think they want to hear,
yeah.
You know? And Fabrizio was so good at that. He was just telling us a story. And I love that. And I was charmed silly, you know?
Yeah.
I was just loving it. He just leaned right over onto the whole table. I was just like, so this is where the coffee's from. And he was just like pointing at this little map. And it was just, I love that.
I wish he'd compete again. He's not going to though, is he?
No, but he trained the Mexican champion this year.
Oh, great.
He was, who I actually judged in Mexico, who was excellent, really, really good. I'm looking forward to seeing him in Colombia. I'm sorry I can't answer that better, though, but Fabrizio was great. But I really enjoy people who kind of own the space, and I like to think of judging as being this kind of opportunity to have four perfect customers.
I had a conversation a couple of days ago with a guy who's not from the coffee industry, but was kind of looking at, he's writing a book about competitors and that kind of thing. And so he wanted to understand the competition a little bit better. And the conversation very quickly kind of cut to the heart of things, which is, so he's like, so the technical points, how much do they matter? And you're like, well, actually, WBC level, not very much. Everyone scores probably within 3 or 4 points of each other technically. And you're like, so is it about the coffee? And you're like, well, no, it's not really about having the perfect coffee. There's no... You know what I mean? For me, I mean, the way I see competition and choosing a coffee for competition is it interesting enough? Yes, no. You know what I mean? I don't think you win barista competition based on having, you know, quote unquote, the best coffee in the world. I don't think that's the route to winning.
Well, sure. But I think there has to be a quality there. And there has to be good coffee. And I think the best espresso normally wins.
Well, I don't think... Well, that's a tricky one. I mean, I think that, you know, in theory, I should be all over that going, yeah, absolutely, it's all about, you know. But once you reach a level of quality, it's very hard to go better. You can certainly go excellent and different.
Well, you and I will both agree that, you know, that in the finals, any of those top six normally could win it. Yes. That if you did it again, you would get different results. And I think it's nearly always so close that it just comes down to how their performance went. And well, that, you know,
this is nearly the thing for me. Like, I think that we, and it's something that I think about a lot, and something that I think a lot of competitors miss completely, is the importance or the impact of the performance itself on the judge. You know, you talked about being charmed, silly, or you know, that the impact of performing as a separate thing outside of technical coffee making, or
you know. It was Simon Robertson. I remember he was over when I was just starting in coffee, 15, 16 years ago. That he had this idea. He was talking about triangle. He ever did this with you? And he's talking about how, like, when you first walk up to a judge's table, ideally they have no concept of who you are. You know, that they haven't made any decisions yet. Hopefully, they might. You know, maybe they have it from your judge's table or how you're dressed or whatever. You know, things that they're not supposed to comment on the score sheets, but they will inevitably just take in, and they're making decisions all the time. But everything you do, everything you say, their perception of you, their impression of you, gets more and more defined, and they're less willing to jump out of that again. That it's hard for a judge to be kind of suddenly charmed when you enter your second course of drinks.
Yeah.
Typically, they've made their decisions on their general impression of you will be made in that opening 45 seconds.
That's I think that's fair. It's a job interview all over again.
Right, but I think, right, and then I also, it's not like it's new thinking, but I always hate the way the competition, so many performances build up to the cig drink. And they kind of, there's a quick opening or kind of a very generic opening. And then it's like, here's the espresso, but let's get on to the cups, you know, or does this kind of, and it's, the espresso is always just a boom. But I do like performances where the espresso is served last, but inevitably the cig drink has this appeal because it's like, what are you going to do with your cig drink? You know, what did they do? What was unique about that? Sure. Cause it's their way, you know, way to show themselves. But I do think that the Fabrizio being a good example, that I was so charmed from the very beginning. Because it's just the way he leaned on the table, you know. I just that was. I know it's silly.
It's great. It's there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And anyone who gets angry about barista competition because a judge was charmed by how a competitor held themselves and acted.
I'm judging this weekend, and if this goes out before then, I wonder how many people will lean on the table.
Where are you judging?
I think I am at the North Central Regional. It's in Chicago.
Okay.
This weekend.
That North used to be.
Yeah.
It used to be the Great Lakes region. The
yeah. Well, it used to be 10 regionals, and this is the first year, I believe, with only 6.
Yeah. I'm looking. They have new names that are all very lettery. That, you know, like
they are. They're a touch convoluted, but you know, they're fine. No, I mean, that's what else can they be? Just make up random names like Julia.
I'll stick to the ridiculous letters.
Yeah.
All right. One last thing I want to talk about, because this is already gone.
There's so much more WBC stuff, though.
But okay, what do you want to talk about WBC stuff?
I don't know.
What?
Don't you wish sometimes that there was like an archive of every cig drink ever made? I would love that.
But why?
Then, because you're just, I just, there's something weird. So I would love to see that sometimes. Because I just think that I'd love to see. Because it's a brown drink, you know? Like, remember your efforts to try to change it?
Yeah, that never worked.
Yeah.
I wanted a red drink. I thought that would be nice.
Oh, I tried that as well with the red velvet thing.
Yeah.
It didn't really work. But you just, like, what are we expecting sometimes? I'd love to see how many drinks and see where they've ranked and what color have they been and how big have they been and see how it's changed over the years. And I, as much as I don't like cig drinks to be the focal point of performances, you can't help but kind of remember that sometimes.
Yeah.
What
was the...
What do you think a six looks like on espresso?
What do I think a six looks like?
Yeah.
Are we doing it the color of crema thing? Are we, like, what does a perfect espresso look like from the top down?
Oh, hold on, I've got a better question. Okay. What do you think of 0 to 6 scoring?
I think it's incredibly flawed.
What would you change it to?
Well, I don't know. It seems weird. So you have a 0 to 6, which is a limited range to begin with. In a way, you can almost take away the two polars numbers. So you could take away 0, unless, you know, it's only used for rule breaking, really.
Right.
And you can take away 6 because people generally are uncomfortable giving the highest possible score because they feel generally exposed, and it's difficult to do, to say, I can't imagine that being better when you know, in a room full of peers who could say, I've had better than that, let alone I can imagine even better than that. That's ridiculous, you know? So you take 0 and 6 out, you're left with 1 to 5. That's not a great range to score.
So what would you change it to?
I would, because I
feel the same way, but I just don't know what I'd change it to.
Well, you know, there's people who do that for a living. Why don't we ask them? There are people who do ranking of foodstuffs and food attributes for a living. That's, they get up in the morning and they think about, how do I rate texture in a liquid? Like, that's what they do. Why don't we ask these people?
These are your friends. These are funny.
I know one or two. But, you know, the sensory science is a big, big deal. It's a huge business. Would it kill us to go and knock on a door and say, hey, just out of curiosity, you know, what's the right way to do this under, you know, because if you listen to Tim Schilling, you know Tim Schilling?
Yep.
If you listen to him talk, one of the big problems we have in the coffee industry generally is that the way we score coffee does not produce statistically significant results. Like, if you give someone a COE score sheet to assess the difference in fermentation times, let's say you have a 17-hour ferment and a 12-hour one. The problem is that the 0 to 8 on so many different attributes, again, it's a pretty narrow range that doesn't produce effective data that gives us answers. So most of the sensory testing that's been done on coffee experiments comes back inconclusive because of the way we score first and foremost. When we all agree there's differences in the cup, but we don't have a very good detection method for them.
Sure. Do you think something similar to more cupping kind of scoring would be better? Where, like, if something is over 90, it doesn't mean it has to be 100, but we just consider it to be of a stellar nature, you know?
I mean, with some stuff, I feel like you could actually take the scoring down to a smaller, like cappuccino foam. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't need to be a 0. Because I reach a point and I'm like, it has enough foam and the foam is really nice. 6. You know,
I'm the same.
There's too much range in a weird sort of way for certain things like that. Or like persistency of crema. Like, I don't need, it's good or it's bad in a way. Like, is it a well-brewed shot, or is there an issue here, or is there not an issue here?
Well, yeah, and it's just trying to articulate what a 6 looks like, consistency and persistency of crema. You know, and I'm using, because we have better, you know, we've got better cameras now. You know, we've got better ways of doing this, and it could do it a renewed effort. And we do have some pretty good materials for the certification we're doing. But as we get a really strong grasp and kind of develop the certification classes that, you know, Fritz Storm, Ali Matuzak are heading up at the moment, that are really, really just solid, as they continue to get better and better, I think the next step is providing educational tools to baristas so that you can go to a web, you can maybe order a book that actually shows 0s to 6s as decided by WBC. Like, and I was, the thing that's really interesting I find sometimes is that, for example, a 3 on visual appearance or cappuccino, that there can be lots of different pours that equal a 3.
Yeah.
That's kind of, I think people find it hard to get out of that thinking that I've seen it. I know I saw that 3 once and someone said that was a 3. So that's what I'm looking for again in order to score a 3 again.
Yeah.
Now you have that kind of selection of criteria of contrast and definition and symmetry and balance and that you kind of try to add them up in some way. And it is a touch convoluted, but then you do somehow, I still believe somehow you do get it after a while. Like, there is, I've judged with other judges who are judged the exact same way as I do. It's hard to kind of identify what's there, but there's definitely people who have the same logic that they're applying, that they use the rules in the same way, and you see very, very consistent scoring. And which would suggest to me that it's something's working, you know, that yeah. it's not totally flawed. There are flaws, absolutely, but somehow it still manages to work. Could it work better? Absolutely. Could it be changed to better? I mean, there's so many simple changes that we could do, and I know there's a willingness to sort of evolve now, which is really, really nice.
Yeah, I think it's a renewed interest in that.
Yeah. And I think it's somewhat due to a lot of young people now being involved as well, and to your point, ex-competitors.
Well, I think interesting that the people I generally agree with most are probably ex-competitors. I think that the times you kind of come up against another judge in a judging room, most of the time I'm coming up against the judge who,
yeah.
And I don't judge much anymore because I'm...
You should.
I probably will again. I think I just, I'm a little saturated with competition at the moment. But you come up against a judge, what?
I mean, you got John competing. Yeah, okay.
Like, you know, I 2005 was the first time I competed, and I ended up going to Seattle as Simon Robertson's kind of coach. Competed 2006, competed 2007. Mm-hmm. You know, it was there, you know, with you 2008. Was there with Gwilym 2009, and was there with John 2010. It's a lot of WBC.
Right, that's fair. I was just thinking, you know, all you need is a 2 month break. And then you get back into it.
But I just don't get the 2 months. I was going to say that whenever I come up against the judge and I feel like there's a real kind of conflict or disagreement,
yeah.
It's usually with a judge where my disagreement is based around them having an unrealistic expectation of coffee preparation. And you just sure. want to go, just
do you think that kind of characteristic is something you see in new judges, or have you seen that in experienced judges? Do you think it's exclusive to either one?
No.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely down to how, I suppose I've in a way made an assessment of, you know, could this person step into that competitor's shoes and do the thing that they are calmly demanding that they should have done?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they're slating someone because they didn't do X, you're like, well, do you know what? Could you go and do that?
Yeah.
And when it's another competitor, you'll find they're real sticklers. Ex-competitors are real sticklers for certain things because they're like, that is so easy. That is such an easy catch. There is no excuse.
It's not like every film critic can make films, you know?
No, but, you know, there's a point where to demand of a director, you should have a pretty good understanding of what is possible as a director.
Sure, I agree with that, but I'm nitpicking on that particular kind of better than any movie you ever made comment, you know.
Yeah.
Feel like
which is totally fair, and equally, I'm not saying that you know there are some great judges that have never been baristas and have never competed, but they have an understanding of the process and a sympathy or an empathy.
I think also those judges are for the most part normally fairly up to date with trends, and they are kind of they're involved in a progressive kind of. Part of the industry, that they're keeping up, you know. I think, we should stop. This is leading somewhere.
Well, we should wrap this one up. Thank you.
Yeah. No, thanks.
And I'll speak to you soon.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Probably.